Evaluation of important agronomic properties of polyhalite fertilizer derived from the Zechstein mineral deposit in the United Kingdom. And Robert?
Okay, thank you, Bill.
Good afternoon, select audience. In England, we call this the death slot because it's the last day and it's after lunch and everybody, they just want to snooze. So I'll try and keep you awake and alert. So you've heard the title from Carl. We're going to talk about the basic physical characteristics of polyhalite. The first questions, obviously, which a farmer would ask is, can I spread it? How does it handle in store? Does it change soil pH? That sort of is the range of topics which we'll come up with. So polyhalite, discovered about 197 years ago by a German chemist, actually, while he was yodeling there outside of Salzburg. Since then, and going forward to the present day, there's been a smattering of scientific interest across the world, a range of crops. Culminates at the moment in the most recent paper that I could find was your very own Ken Barbeck. Ken incidentally supported our agronomic case when it came to planning in the UK. So here's a world map focused down on Europe. The blue area is the Zechstein deposit, the darker area is the deeper seam, and the lighter area is a shallower seam. So the Zechstein Sea basically evaporated at the end of the Permian-Triassic period about 250 million years ago. It left us with two seams, which we can mine in North Yorkshire and the northeast coast of the UK. So we actually are based around about here. And at that point, we have seams which are up to 80 metres thick and 91% pure polyhalite. By the time you get over here, towards Poland and Germany, that seam is only a few metres thick and only about 40% pure. Shame. So polyhalite, bit of a misnomer. It's Greek meaning many salts. It's not many, it's one. They're all sulfates. It's actually a hydrated salt, polyhalite. It's calcium, magnesium, potassium sulfate. And that's probably all I can tell you about the mineralogy of it. So here we've got some discussions coming up. All the topics on the right-hand side is where I'll touch on going forward. In terms of nutrient content, this is what it says on the label. 14% potassium oxide, 90% sulfur, 70% calcium oxide, and 6% magnesium oxide. So what we do is we take the mineral ore out of the ground, haul it up about 1,500 metres, take it to the surface. It's ground down to a particle size of about 175 microns, glued back together with a binder, and you actually create standard agricultural pellet, which looks like this pretty picture down here. So if you were to beneficiate it, you could, in theory, turn it into sulfate of potash. If you did that, you'd lose all these beneficial trace elements. Now, I said to you it's 91% pure. Your next question is going to be, so what's the rest of it? Well, the rest of it is, in terms of other mineralogy, it's mica. There's a little bit of gypsum, apatite. There's a little bit of salzbonite, syngite, hexahydrite, magnesite. Anhydrite and gypsum is the larger proportion of the non-polyhalite part of the ore. So what we've done in terms of characterizing the product ourselves is we've given 137 samples to SGS Laboratories, internationally recognized operation. They've analyzed them for their nutrient content. I've plotted them out as a frequency diagram here. So for example, we're aiming at what it says on the label up here, 48% sulfur trioxide. I apologize, it's in oxides. In Europe, we have a legal obligation to report macronutrients in oxides. So if you look at the population curve there of sulfur trioxide, it's a range, and the way it's constructed is I can now ascribe upper and lower confidence intervals of 50.48 to 51.08. So what you can see basically at that point in time, although it's a variable material, actually we far and exceed the requirement of the label, which is very good. It means we've given it away to farmers and growers. I guess nobody's going to complain. So you can do the same with every population curve that I've got there, all the way down to your left-hand side, little red blip on the left. What is that? That's chlorine. So if you look at the upper confidence interval there, 2.77, what we'll say on the label is less than 3%. So we can meet specification even though it's a variable natural material. Next thing any farmer and grower is going to want to know is it a fertilizer? Well, the first requisite of a fertilizer is that the nutrients go into solution and those nutrients will then be taken up by the plant. So if you look at graph one, what we've done there, we've put our product, Poly4, into a very dilute solution. The purpose being there to describe how each individual element comes into solution. So what you notice is that all elements come into solution around about the same time. And that really just underlines the fact that this is one single lattice structure. It's not a mixture of various sulfate salts. It's one big molecule, if you like. Next thing you want to know is, okay, so how fast does this material go into solution? Top dark line up here is MOP, graph 2 I'm talking about, sorry. Below that you have a lime green line, which is polyhalite going into solution, a little bit slower. A little bit lower down you've got langbeinite, which is the light blue line. Finally, section 3 down here. Basic question is going to be, so how soluble is it? So what we have here is graphs of solubility against temperature. Again, SGS in France undertook this task for us. What you see is basically horizontal lines. It's popping up a little bit on the right-hand side, as you expect, abiding by the law of physics. A little bit warmer, solubility increases. There's nothing catastrophic there. It'd be a shame if polyhalite suddenly fell out of solution at 30 degrees, and thank the Lord it doesn't. Lowest line you've got there is gypsum with its solubility around about 2.5 grams per litre. We know that as a nutrient source, it works quite well. Above that you have polyhalite and above that sulphate of potash. If you want to put 27 grams per litre, which is the solubility SGS ascribed to at 25 degrees Celsius, then that really equates to a loam soil, average moisture content after draining, PF2 if you like, that there has a capacity to absorb 10 tonnes per hectare of our Poly4 product. I wouldn't advise you to put that amount on, but that's the capacity of the soil. One of the next basic questions that we were asked about, this was what the salt index. Now, salt index, if you look in the literature, an awful lot of literature actually uses the old-fashioned radar method, not really reproducible. We've had to go to the current laboratories, and we've used 7 laboratories throughout the world, through US, South America, out to China. So we've taken all these 4 potash materials, passed them through these laboratories. What you have there is the mean of all 7 laboratories and standard deviation. At the end of the day, what is important to a plant is osmotic potential in the root zone. So any fertilizer you put on the soil, any salt you put in that environment is actually elevating electrical conductivity. So we're using electrical conductivity as a way of measuring the osmotic potential of that soil root environment. So what you have, there are reference points here from FAO data of the light and dark blue lower graphs. These are the points in terms of electrical conductivity measured in decisiemens per meter at which you would get a 10% yield impediment. The green bar graphs are actually the worst case scenarios I found, having analyzed 34 trials which we conducted until January this year. So if we've put these into light, low potash bearing soils, around about 50 to 80 parts per million, we've added, we supplied the potash requirement according to the standard local fertilizer recommendations exclusively from our product Poly4. At the end of the trial, measure EC. So basically what we need to do is look down and say, for example, tomatoes, at the end of the trial, soil EC 2.1. If you look, scribe down vertically, you'll come up against the 10% yield impediment limit of 3.5. So in reality, Nothing unusual, quite a safe product, not going to cause an issue of electrical conductivity. Next basic question a lot of people are going to ask. In fact, there was one local English agronomist who embarrassingly said that polyhalite will have a very detrimental effect on soil pH because it's got a lot of sulfur. I think the experienced agronomists amongst you who realize that polyhalite is a sulfate, that's really not going to happen. And basically what I've given you here is a snapshot of increasing application rates of polyhalite as applied from poly 4 product. At supplying the K2O levels is indicated here on the x-axis. The pH is a horizontal, there's clearly no effect on pH. If you take that same set of data from 22 trials, do a meta-analysis of it, top left-hand graph, that's the green sector there actually indicates that there is no significant difference with a probability factor of 0.05 between adding no potassium and adding the crop potassium requirement from poly 4. If you look at the other three circles, you basically have a similar effect there, but what the statistics are comparing is, was there a significant difference between the soil pH at the end of the trial when SOP, as against poly 4, supplied that potassium requirement, or against SOPM, or against MOP. Again, you're in the sort of ballpark, 80 to 85% at the time. The answer statistically, no significant difference. Further, just to give a little bit of a snapshot of other items that we've tested. So we've looked at crush strength. Crush strength comes out to be 5.5 kilos force. That effectively means that you can spread the product with spinning disc spreaders. You can also spread it with an air blast spreaders, which actually are a little bit more aggressive on the particle. In terms of spreadability, as I said, we've regranulated it, which means it's a standard agricultural pellet, somewhere between 2 and 4 millimeters, and therefore it's very uniform. It'll spread very evenly on its own or in a blend. So we've tested it with independent SCS. They are a recognized professional body. They actually test spreaders for a living, and it's part of the requirement in the UK to get your spreader tested for quality assurance purposes. So what you see is, whether it's in a blend or as a straight, you've got a coefficient of variation of 5. So it's perfectly even. That's a very good result. If you get somewhere between 10 to 20% variation, then you're going to start to see stripes in the crop. Next thing, we went over to Holland, very important for people who keep in the product for a long time in the shed. Then caking propensity. Their comment was near zero. Compatibility, the blenders amongst you will be fully aware of the compatibility triangle. It's a very standard document, and we've done a very similar testing, and again, they're perfectly compatible, no issues, and in fact, as far as we're aware, there's no caking issue, even with items which are very prone to caking, such as ammonium sulfate. And that will take probably about 18 months before you even start to see a problem. So as far as people are concerned, it'll sit in the shelf a long time and it's going to blend very well. In terms of our agronomy workload, if you like, or what we've managed to achieve over the past 2 years, our trial basis covered over 100 trials. 77 of those trials are in the field, over 8 countries, 25 crops. So hopefully it's a robust program. If you wait here a little bit longer, you'll hear about some of our trials which we've done with collaborators here in the USA. I can't leave the stage without thanking all the cooperating agencies and staff who have provided this data and many other data for our global agronomy program. Thank you for listening. Sorry, could you repeat?
How does this material compare in price to K-Bag?
Price.
Priced.
Yeah. Well, we did cheaper. Well, yes, significantly cheaper.
Thank you very much.